This is XTP Media.
Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
You're listening to Extended. Your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 50 of Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. And joining me today is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Hello, everybody.
And Executive Editor of Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer. Gareth, how are you today?
I'm really good, Peter. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. Looking forward to today's episode. It's our 50th. I think that's silver in weddings, isn't it?
Or is it? Are we technically married, aren't we?
feels like it sometimes. But today we've got some great feature segments for you. We've got a great interview with Red 7 from the Red Arrows and an interview with Ron Smith on general aviation. They're both subjects you've asked us to cover, and we've saved them up for our 50th episode. Also in the programme, we've got some feedback promoting aerospace and a little look back on this year and a look ahead to the new year as well. But as always, let's get started by what's caught our eye in the news. So our first story then is the Strategic Defence Review from the UK, and of course it could be from any aviation publication, but our story is from Flight Global. Let me come to you first then, Gareth. We've got the Poseidons there. There is some discussion going around about whether it meets the spec and whether the Nimrod still outperforms the Poseidon. What's your take on it?
I think my take with Nimrod, Peter, is it's gone, and when people need to draw a line under that, as far as I'm concerned, I understand why people are having that debate. You know, we got to a situation with MRA-4 with, you know, aircraft had flown and the aircraft were, you know, broken up on the ground before they ever entered service. So I understand that, but we've taken a big step with SDSR now, and it couldn't have been a bigger contrast to 2010, of course. Lots of good stuff in there. And the big step as an island nation that hasn't had a specialist maritime patrol capability for the last however many years it is that we've just literally stepped in now and ordered 9 P-8 Poseidons, which I think has to be great news. What's the point of continuing to debate about Nimrod? It's not like the two aircraft are in competition. So I think we have to move forward, and and I think we've got a very capable aircraft coming our way.
Yeah, and Tim, if I can come to you then, what about the procurement process for the P-8s? I mean, are Airbus, Lockheed, Northrop Grumman, amongst others, disappointed to lose out?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they were obviously hoping that it'd be opened up to a competition, and there'd be some kind of, like, you know, contest or fly-off. They'd be able to put their best solutions forward. You know, Airbus had the C-295, Lockheed had the C-130J, Alenia Aramaki was at MC-27. So they're all trying to get in. They're all sort of also, you know, playing up the British industry angle of how much UK content they could put on it. But I think the problem with that is that, you know, if you start start gold plating a turboprop MPA, you end up very rapidly heading down the road where, you know, it ends up being expensive and late. The P8, you know, it's a known quantity. It's from Boeing. It plugs into the massive US Navy procurement. The Australians are buying it. Indians have already got it. They're talking about, the first three by 2020, I think. So it's going to be in service, relatively quickly, I think.
Yeah, talking about expensive and overdue, the announcement was also there on the F-35 Lightning IIs, of course, 138 airframes confirmed, Gareth. Do we know what types they've been confirmed as?
Yeah, that was a very smart segue, by the way, I think, going for overpriced and late. It's a nice link. Off the top of my head, I don't know, to be honest, if anybody has worked out what the split's going to be. I guess the fact that we committed to kind of go for the full whack, and I think a third squadron, there's an additional squadron in there, as well as two additional Typhoon squadrons, it was as I said a couple of minutes ago, it couldn't have been a bigger contrast to what we were all sitting here looking at five years ago, and I guess that yeah, it just reflects the world we live in, I suppose. And we're going to come on to talk about Syria, I'm sure. But actually, if you look at, and the Flight Global it's a great article. It literally just goes on and on and on, all this all this capability. And it's impressive, to be honest. And I have to say, I was quite surprised.
The extra Typhoon squadrons, is that additional airframes, Tim?
That is, I think it works out as one extra squadron. I think that's when you join it up with the F-35s. But they are essentially, as far as we know, that was going to be stuff that was going to be retired or put up into storage of the Tranche 1s. So they're coming back as austere ground attack, but also interceptors. So I think the idea there is they will be on QRA and they will be, anything you don't need Paveway 4 or Brimstone or an AESA radar in the future, you can keep these in and deploy them down in Falklands, chase down bears with them, and they're good enough to do that. It's right. Kind of a fleet within a fleet, so it's not perfect, but the alternative was they were trying to putting them in a shed or trying to flog them.
Yeah, and the Tornado GL4s need to keep going for a little bit longer as well, don't they? Which is good news. It's proving to be a reliable platform.
Yeah, I mean, I'd just like to back Gareth's point on there. It is a stunningly good outcome for air power in this review both from last time and just anyway, the 138 Lightnings, F-35s, people had written off that you talk to anybody and the consensus was amongst many defence analysts, many serious defence analysts, that no, we'd only get 48. 48 was going to be the max. So for them to say, we're going for the full programme record, obviously there's time scales, but they accelerate and get those onto, the first 24 deployed on the carriers, that's, a real sort of a turnaround. So, good stuff.
Peter, if I could just quickly jump in on Tornado GR4. I actually, the day of the announcement and the debate actually happened to be my day off that week, so I put my feet up and put the news on or put the Parliament Channel on and actually sat and listened to and watched the whole thing. About 20 minutes or so after the announcement, in the questions that followed, Dr. Liam Fox, former Defence Secretary, of course, stood up and asked the Prime Minister what the announcement meant for the out-of-service date of the Tornado GR4. He also asked him a second question. The second question got answered. The Tornado GR4 question got completely ignored, and I texted a friend of mine who just happens to be a Tornado GR4 pilot and said, the Prime Minister has just ignored a question about the GR4's out of service date. And I got a text message back almost instantly saying, yep, we all noticed that too.
Well, there was some other good news as well on fixed wing, and it was lost in a bit of the detail, but looks like we might be getting two more King Airs, the 350 CERs as well, Tim.
The Shadow, yeah, that's come about as well. Obviously, Protector drones got kind of leaked beforehand. Zephyr, we talked about Zephyr. That was also pre-leaked, and you know, that's another sort of ISR capability. And also, they're kind of running now. I think that's AWACS E3 D AWACS to 2030, I think, which is which is pretty right out to 2030. So that's seems to imply there'll be some kind of upgrade for that. I don't see how you could keep going with the current system until sort of 2030.
Yeah. And
as is
rotary. The we haven't seen the detail, or certainly I'm. Wasn't able to find it about whether we were going to upgrade or buy new on the Apaches as well.
I'm not sure a final decision's been made on that, has it?
No.
From my understanding.
There has been a request for an upgrade, you know, the foreign sales request for put to the U.S. State Department. So the State Department, as the U.S. State Department has already said, yep, you know, we've had this request from the U.K., and it would be to go to the E model, which is, you know, remanufactured ones. You give them to Boeing, and they'll go up to sort of like the U.S. the latest U.S. Army standard. So it'll be kind of new engines, data links, Link 16, all the good stuff.
Right, okay. Now, some of this equipment, as we said, is already in service, and in Syria there has been a lot of activity. The Germans, the French, and very recently the British have again responded with military force. One of the things that's coming up a great deal in the press is the use of the Brimstone missile, Tim. And there seems to be a belief that the Americans don't have this capability. Is that right, or is this just a little bit of jousting going on?
Well, you know, it's certainly right that the Americans haven't got it. I mean, the MBDA has been trying to interest in the you know, the US in the Brimstone for a while now, with little success. So it has been trialed and fired off a Predator or a Reaper over there. I think it's a dual mode anti-armor weapon. So it's got a microwave radar on there, and it's also got a laser seeker as well. So what that means is it's a fire and forget anti-armor, but it's also very, very good for using it in urban, cluttered environments. In particular, in Libya in 2011, there was a whole coastal town that was kind of off limits to coalition airstrikes, and Gaddafi's regime forces were making, you know, was making a lot of progress in there. Then the Americans had ruled it off because they said, you know, it's too difficult to go in there and tell who's who and actually prosecute strikes. We can't go in there because there's too much risk of collateral damage. And to the Brits to sort of put their hand up and sort of say, oh, hang on, we've got this weapon, we can try this. And so the Americans went off after that, being very, very impressed with the capabilities of Brimstone. I've got a feeling it's been flagged up a little bit more than, you know, it's not a wonder weapon. It's certainly not going to kind of win any war with ISIS all by itself. I mean, you know, and there's also Paveway 4 in there, which is a very, very capable weapon, very accurate. But I think it's been kind of, I hate to say, blown out of proportion. it's been a little bit, I think it's probably been a little bit bigged up in order to sort of say, look, these are these are the precautions we are taking to ensure that there is as minimum collateral and civilian casualties as possible. And I think it's important to note here, you know, just on a sort of side note, is that, you know, the UK has been bombing ISIS in Iraq without a single civilian casualty.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously people sort of say, well, you know, you're not doing as much as the Russians have done. Yeah, because the Russians have turned up and you know,
carpet bombed,
you know, they're out of strategic bombers. So we've been very, very precise and you know, unprecedented sort of I would imagine ROEs in that in there. I would imagine also that probably ISIS have worked that out by now themselves. So it's a real sort of there's a disconnect between the some of the sort of sort of anti-bombing, anti-war, anti kind of things of you're going to be sort of like murdering babies, it's a genocide, and what the RAF is actually doing there in terms of making sure it is just the right people that get hit and it's just the bad guys.
Tim, without wishing to get all political on the subject as well, do you also think that the we've got capability Russian partners don't have was an important strand in the argument the government used or the Prime Minister used?
I think so. Yeah, I think it helped, doesn't it? You know, it was also, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder with France. Yeah, so you know, if Paris is so, I think there was that sort of argument coming in there as well. I don't think anyone actually sort of said we've been asked for it because we've got a super weapon, or you know, somebody had obviously briefed the politicians that you know nobody else has this. We're really precise. It's a really precise weapon, you know, and it makes a contribution.
Yeah, I saw Paul Beaver read in the printed press and heard him on several audio programs talking about it. Of course, Paul was a guest on our last main episode, and in the BBC article, he says it could kill someone sitting in a car outside a house, with the only damage being to the house being perhaps a couple of broken windows. So I suppose that says it all. We're talking about Syria. There mentioned it a few times. Of course, we now have UK forces in Syria. What's the role of the Eurofighters that are out there at the moment? Do we know what their role is?
Well, I mean, we've now seen that the Typhoons have been deployed to Cyprus. I think it's six or eight.
So
they've been flying in mixed pairs. What seems like six mixed pairs with the Tornadoes. So what it does is it gives them an extra bit of combat power, but it almost importantly it kind of boosts the situational awareness and Tornadoes. So you've got the Typhoon there. It's got an amazing radar. It's got an incredible defensive aid DAS system. So it can look out, it can see better situational awareness, what's going on in the battle space, look out for threats. It's got a towed decoy as well on it. So by pairing those together, you know, the Tornado has got a backseater as well. So if they're prosecuting, you know, targets in urban areas, you've got a backseater who can kind of concentrate on stuff. And obviously, Typhoon also is a phenomenal air-to-air fighter.
Tim, dare I ask the question, are the Typhoons there because of the situation with the Russians and the shoot down?
Well, I mean, the Turks, there was a NATO ally that shot.
But, have we put the Typhoons because of the threat to our aircraft?
Well, there was no real air-to-air threat in Libya, and the both of them were together. So it's extra combat power. But it doesn't hurt, does it? It doesn't hurt to have if you've got kind of flankers there, toting air-to-air missiles around, if you've got S-400 SAM systems, putting your latest fourth-generation fighter in there, you know, and kind of upping the ante a little bit and saying, you know, we are taking this seriously. We're giving those Tornadoes a bit of extra protection, a bit of extra kind of muscle, you know, not saying that we're starting World War III, but it's just sort of saying, you know, hey, you know, Typhoons are in theatre. Make of it what you will.
And what ELINT capability does NATO have in that part of the world at the moment, Tim? Because, of course, with all that Russian hardware flying around, you know, we've got Russian cruise missiles, we've got all sorts of things. It's got to be a situation where there's a massive opportunity to gain some significant intelligence on all that hardware.
Well, I'm sure there'll be people there devoted to doing just that. They'll be hoovering up the electrons. UK obviously has got rivet joint stroke air seeker, depending on who you want to talk to there. You know, kind of US will have similar capabilities in over there. So yeah, the people will be listening to each other's. There's been Russian spy planes kind of circling off the coast of the Med, trying to pick up stuff. So yeah, everyone will be trying to listen to everybody else. and see what they can pick up. So it's a bit of a sort of an intelligence game there as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's come closer to home. The Royal Aeronautical Society hosted an event a few weeks ago at which the CAA announced a relaxing of the regulations on general aviation aircraft and self-builds. Tim, this is fantastic news for the UK GA sector.
Right, yeah. So this is sort of called e-regulations. The Royal Aeronautical Society have been working with this, well, proposed this sort of a while back. It's finally come to pass, and the CAA have put it into
sort regulation. Of,
that was the word I was looking for. In the US, you've got a whole class called experimental, which basically sort of says, you know, you can go and build your own aircraft, you can design it, test fly it, and you can fly it, and it's a whole lot more relaxed to basically let people experiment and design new aircraft and have fun, and not be bound by the same sort of regulations that you'd have for a 737 or something like that, a little bit more complicated than that. In the UK, it's not going to be exactly the same as the US experimental regulations. You're not going to be able to sort of have an aircraft on there permanently, but what it will do is it will have that sort of class of license to be able to do sort of like the design and the test phase.
Yeah,
so during the test phase the rules will be kind of much more So you can also say lax, but more relaxed and more sort of flexible, and a little bit more sort of friendly to the designer. And yeah. Hopefully what this will do is it will spark a renaissance and a new sort of growth in UK GA design, which has been stifled in recent years. People have just gone and looked at it and gone, blooming heck, you know, the cost of getting a certification. Then I've got to go to the CAA, then I've got to do EASA. And people have just looked at it and been put off by that whole paperwork problem, of just getting it to flying it and test flying something, you know. So yeah, big step really in the UK GA sector. Will it
bring some innovation? You know, hopefully.
Well, hopefully, you know,
really
maybe not overnight.
Yeah,
but there's already people there with some interesting looking designs, and I think this will just kind of this will just spur things on, you know.
Yeah, the interesting thing is it's also for new concept aircraft up to a maximum takeoff weight of 2,000 kilos. That's pretty decent size aircraft, actually. It's not all small balsa wood home builds, is it? It's a pretty decent size aircraft, 2 tons.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea is to reinvigorate the entire sort of, you know, light aircraft. So it's a light aircraft industry, so it might not be. There's people who are talking about, you know, production sized aircraft if they got going.
Yeah.
But it's just that sort of test, the test phase, the development phase that has been in the past, the real sort of stumbling block.
Well, kudos to the Royal Aeronautical Society for pushing that one. Okay, let's look a bit further afield. Let's go upwards. December the 15th is approaching, Gareth, and that is the date that our UK astronaut, Major Tim Peake, of course a previous guest on the show, will be launching to the International Space Station. Very exciting times.
Right, I mean, it is incredibly exciting, isn't it? It's been great to see him a few weeks ago doing, you know, loads of PR and TV appearances in the UK and everything as well, really building up awareness of the trip. Obviously it's going to be the second highlight for him, having been on extended. it's brilliant. It seems, I mean, Tim was on the show when? I mean, I don't know if I'd have to look it up.
It was in the first 10 somewhere. I think the first 5 maybe.
December 2015 seemed like a long way off, like a date far, far away, to coin a phrase. And here we are. So yeah, very excited. Wish him all the best and really looking forward to following all of his exploits whilst he's in space, which of course we can do very, very easily these days.
Yeah, he's gonna run the London Marathon apparently in space. So that'll be interesting. Well, not
slightly cheating there when you're going that speed.
You'll probably win. Yeah, surely.
Yeah.
He's got some good stuff. He's doing a great deal of STEM outreach as well. He's been fantastic on social media. I sort of get it that it's not his thing, but he's really, really doing a great job and reaching out. And there's a lot of pride seeing what he's done so far. And really looking forward to the 15th. So I've got my alarm set to watch that take off. We think it's mid-late morning, so put it on your schedules.
You shouldn't need your alarm if it's that time of day.
I'm supposed to be working. So I might need to be woken up. Hope no one's listening. Sorry, boss. Okay, let's move on then. After this break, Gareth, we're going to come to you for the first of our feature segments.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Hi, this is Diego López Salazar from Aeropodcast, and you're listening to Extended.
I suppose this is by public demand, really. It's an absolute honour and a privilege to interview a current member of the Royal Air Force Aerobatic Team, the Red Arrows, for Extended, and how fitting for our 50th episode that we should have such a high profile interview. So without further ado, here's Flight Lieutenant Tom Bold, Red 7 from the Red Arrows. Flight Lieutenant Tom Bold, RAF Red Arrows, Red 7, welcome to Extended. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you.
You and I met 5 years, well, not too far off, 6 years ago now, when you were the 2010 Royal Air Force Decano display pilot. Does that seem like a lifetime ago now?
Yeah, it does actually, yeah. A lot's gone on since then. But yeah, I still look back on that very fondly. That was... that was a great time, but a lot's happened since then.
Now, before we get to the Red Arrows part of it, which I know everyone's going to want to hear about, you were very clear back in 2010 that you hoped your next step, your venture onto the front line was going to be with the Eurofighter Typhoon, and having gone back to Valley and done your tactical weapons training, it was indeed Typhoon. Just tell us a little bit about what that step was like, what the jet's like, and you know, you're genuinely on the front line in Typhoon, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, it was flying the Tucano firstly in the 2010 was a real privilege and a great experience, and then to go back through training to do my tactical weapons and then get selected to Typhoon again was it was another dream, really. I was in the right place at the right time, and I was lucky enough to go and fly it. I was posted to one squadron at RAF Leaders, and yeah, it was again, it was a real privilege. The jet is a phenomenal aircraft to fly. It's incredibly powerful and incredibly capable. So when I was up at Leaders, we went on a few detachments. So we went to Malaysia. I spent quite a bit of time in the Falkland Islands, and also spent quite a lot of time on QRA in the UK, effectively doing the job of securing the skies. So yeah, it was great. It was hard work, but very enjoyable at the same time.
Well, it's fantastic that part of your dream was realised, Tom, but the display flying bug clearly hadn't gone away, and I'm guessing you have to fulfil some certain criteria to apply for the Reds, but you did, and you got in. I know it's very, very competitive. Just finding out that you got in, what was that moment like?
Yeah, it was very surreal, actually. In fact, the day I, in fact, the week I found out was, yeah, it was all a surreal blur. We'd just, had the birth of our second child, I think a couple of days before, and then I think it was on the Friday, so I'm looking after Eleanor, and all of a sudden I get the phone call that was you've been selected for the Red Arrow. So that whole whole process was a bit of a sleep deprived blur. But yeah, that has to be one of the best weeks of my life. Yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, from a purely piloting point of view, Tom, you wouldn't have been selected for the team if you weren't going to be able to do it. But you know, we've seen from particularly from the TV documentaries we've been on, this is very demanding flying, isn't it? And although you've got a taste of low level aerobatics in the Tucano, I'm guessing that whilst there might be some similarities, it's chalk and cheese in other regards.
Yeah, it is, and that's quite an interesting one. So having spent a year being a solo display pilot, you get very used to and what that's like. So you get used to kind of that feeling of what it's going to be like in front of a crowd. But you're on your own, so you're making all those decisions yourself. Being part of the Red Arrows is being part of that team, and you've got to be in the right place at the right time. And actually, we do things on timing more than anything else. So we do a lot of the flying by what you hear rather than what you can see. So it looks like we're all moving at the same time. And that was the thing that took me the most amount of training and I found the most demanding part. So yeah, they have similarities, but they are very, very different.
Did you genuinely sort of have any moments when you thought, God, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do this?
Yeah, I'd be lying if I didn't say there was a bit of trepidation there. And every step, you're constantly thinking about what's coming up next. But we start off early. I mean, at the moment, we're now practicing for the 2016 season. So you start that training early. So you've got about 5-6 months until the display has to come together. So we put everything in a very much a building block approach. So the jumps aren't too big, but that learning curve is constantly there. So it's all manageable. But it's quite daunting when you first start to realise the standard you're at, but where you need to be in 6 months' time.
And that approach is actually very similar to what you did with the Tucano, isn't it? In terms of it may be different, but in terms of it physically being blocks, you know, you came down in altitude, didn't you? You took steps down, and you were supervised the whole way through, weren't you? So I guess those elements will be some of those elements will be exactly the same.
Yeah, and the approach to learning is very similar to the way the Air Force teaches flying in general. Everything's done in a very much in a staged approach, in that building block approach. But for the Red Arrows, it's just subtly different with the building blocks that we have.
So where was your first public display as a Royal Air Force Red Arrows pilot?
Yeah, the first public display was at it was Llandudno. Yeah, and I remember that well. There was it's kind of nervous excitement on the day of it and walking out to the jet. I mean, we'd known that we'd been PDA'd, so we'd done that display quite a few times up to this point. But knowing that this was the first time your public display was. Yeah, it was quite exciting, but nervous at the time. But then as soon as you got in the aircraft, yeah, kind of everything else took over, and all of a sudden you're just concentrating on what you're doing. And actually, all of a sudden those nerves go out the window, and you're just looking forward to it.
And afterwards?
Yeah, kind of excitement and relief at the same time. But it was, the weather was nice, the display was nice. So yeah, that was quite a nice moment that the first one was underway. But then you still know there's about another 70 to go.
Now there was some really nice synergy with this season and what you did with the Tucano. Obviously 2010 we were commemorating the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. Here you are 5 years later in the Red Arrows, and obviously the 75th is even bigger. I mean, that's two very nice seasons for starters, isn't it? And I'm pretty sure there's some nice highlights for you from this season that are particularly sort of Battle of Britain related.
Yeah, there were. I mean, actually we got to do some great stuff this season. So two of obviously every display was great, and we really enjoyed doing those. But kind of two of the highlights for me was we got to fly with the Vulcan, and we also got to fly quite a bit with the Battle of Britain Memorial flight.
Yeah.
So as you mentioned, it's the 75th anniversary this year, and it's kind of looking back at what those guys did back then. So they were securing the skies for the UK, and we managed to do some mixed formation fly paths with them this year. We was at Duxford, Cosford. And that was just a real privilege when all of a sudden they come up behind you and you see those warbirds It was a real privilege to do that.
We saw a little bit of this in the documentaries that have run here in the UK in the last few weeks, but how demanding is it putting 9 Hawk jets in the sky with, you know, a Spitfire or Spitfires or Hurricanes?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite demanding for the boss, because he's the one that's got to sort out the joints.
Yeah.
But for us, I mean, we're just kind of concentrating on doing what we're doing. The boss is flying slower than he normally does, so they can keep up. So it just means the formations are a little bit more tricky for us. But the harder thing is staring at the boss to make sure you're in the right position and not glancing over your shoulder and looking at the warbirds.
Now, moving into your second season, as you say, you've already started. I know you've had a sort of short break at the end, and now you're back into training already. So a couple of things on that. The first one has to be that you're now Red 7, which means that you're Synchro 2. This has got to be surely every Red Arrow's dream, I would imagine.
Yeah, and again, I'm just privileged to be selected for it. Yeah, I mean, I was very keen to be Synchro 2 this year, and lucky that I was selected to do it. So we've started the work up now, already down at 100 feet, and we've started doing some inverted flying. So there's brand new skills to learn, brand new building blocks to get there. But yeah, again, it's a massive privilege, but it's a lot of fun already.
How different does it feel going into year 2, if maybe you look back 12 months to when you were just starting? Is there a sort of there must be a confidence there that you know, maybe you had to develop when you started 12 months ago?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because it was a bit of an uncertainty this time last year. But, you know, would I be able to cope with it? What would the season be like? What would it be like displaying in front of everybody as part of a Red Arrow? Having got that year under your belt, there is that kind of level of confidence that actually I've done it for years, so I know what it's like, so I know what's coming up. But being Synchro 2, I've got a whole bunch of new stuff to learn, so there is that kind of nervous excitement at the same time.
Fantastic. Well, I can't let you go just without asking about the PR and all the ground stuff that you do, because I know obviously you got a taste of that in 2010, but I think we all know that the Red Arrows is a different kettle of fish, and I guess a huge part of what you do is not really connected with flying at all, is it? It's everything else.
It is, and that's a great part of it. So we obviously spend a lot of time concentrating on the display and trying to do the best display that we can, but then when we land somewhere and we're either hosting or we're lucky enough to go and meet the public, and that's a real great honour and a privilege, actually, to be able to go and talk to people and see what they think, and actually get to be able to interact and tell them about it.
As an overall point, Tom, you know, the Red Arrows are world renowned, very much the sort of public face of the Royal Air Force. I mean, you've mentioned privilege a couple of times, but I kind of, that probably doesn't even get close, does it? I mean, this must be a real pinnacle.
It is, and it feels like that as well, and it's very difficult to describe apart from it's hugely enjoyable, and to be able to represent the Air Force and do what we do is great. I mean, it feels like actually there's quite a lot of pressure on there, because we're representing everybody. There's lots of people who are working very hard in operations, out in some unpleasant places, but yeah, we're here, and we are effectively representing them, so there's always that going on. But at the same time, it's just a huge privilege, and able to fly some of the flights we get to do, fly with some of the other aircraft that we get to fly with, and then doing everything else. And yeah, it's great.
Well, it's brilliant to catch up again. Yeah, well done for ticking all these boxes that were things that you were hoping to do when we first met. And really, really appreciate you joining us for a chat. Good luck with all your training, and it goes without saying, you know, good luck for a fantastic 2016 season, Tom.
Great, thank you very much.
Thanks ever so much.
Well done, Gareth. That's taken some time, I know, to get one of the Red Arrows onto the show. It's been an objective of ours for some time. So well done on that. Great interview. Really enjoyed it. I wanted it to go on forever, but we know he's a very a very busy guy.
One of the things I thought was quite amusing, we've heard the audio from the Red Arrows, but I'd never really understood the significance at the point that you made about training using voice commands and how challenging it was. You know, these are the creme de la creme of pilots, but he was finding something that I suppose we all assumed would be so natural really, really challenging.
Yeah, and this whole thing of the, you know, flying from what they hear.
Yeah.
Is absolutely extraordinary. And I was interested in the contrast to what he'd done, you know, as the Tucano display pilot to then going to fly with the Red Arrows. And of course the it turns out really the only sort of consistent thing there is that it's low level aerobatics. Apart from that, it's chalk, you know, it is chalk and cheese, as we said. And it is incredibly demanding. And I think anybody who's watched the TV documentaries will be aware of that, you know. Yeah. And whilst I think that the pilots themselves are, you know, this whole sort of superhero, you know, daredevil stunt pilots thing, I think they, you know, some people would argue about this, but the Reds would generally try and play that down. this is, you know, this is, to me, it's the pin, you know, it's the pinnacle. No question. And it's still the thing that lots and lots of people want to do and not many people get to do.
And I think also it's interesting what you were talking to him about how, you know, the kind of flying is just part of it. You know, a lot of it is the ambassadorial role. You know, are you good in kind of social situations? Are you, you know,
yeah.
I'm sure one of the questions now is, you know, what's your Twitter profile and do you understand social media? You know, those sort of things as to, you know, not just being a good skill pilot, but being an ambassador for the RAF. And you know, to be fair now, there's more of a burden now on the Reds because you've got one kind of outreach or one sort of visible part of the RAF, the search and rescue, which is now over in the private sector. So yeah, that's one less thing to kind of sort of you know, for people to kind of look at and go, oh yes, that's the Royal Air Force. That's where my, you know, that's where our sort of taxpayers' money go, and that's where what, you know, we who defend us.
Yeah, and certainly with social media as well, it's almost to some extent a full time job, whether you're at an air show or not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you're only ever your phone or tablet or computer away from communicating with the world as a Red Arrow. So it is a massive part of what they do, no question.
And did I get the hint that there's going to be some new manoeuvres in the next season?
Well, I think there will be. I know that Dave Montenegro, who's Red One, is keen to do that. And actually, in the last few weeks, he has revealed some scribbles and some thoughts on via social media, funnily enough. And so I think, again, yeah, we'll see a different, fresh display next year, which I think the team is always keen to do. And the one thing I like about that is when they bring back something that maybe they haven't done for a while, because you can remember it from when you were maybe a kid watching the team, which I always think is quite nice. And just on a personal level, having interviewed Tom the first time nearly 6 years ago when he was doing the Tucano display, it was fantastic to see him get Typhoon. It was incredible to see him get into the Red Arrows. It's brilliant. But now to see him in Synchro is just unbelievable. So well done, Tom, and thank you very much.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
Okay, and now to a review that I did with Ron Smith about his latest book, Classic Light Aircraft. It's a real visual feast on general aviation aircraft. I also got to talk to Ron about the aircraft he featured and the great photographs in the book. classic light aircraft published by Schiefer Publishing is a hardback book of over 400 pages. It's written by Ron Smith, and this is a real feast of aircraft photographs and information that will keep most enthusiasts entertained for hours on end. Comfortable as a coffee table book or on the bookshelf, it's big, it's heavy, and from a value perspective alone, worth the £30, or in American dollars, $34.99, you'd shell out for it. Says it all on the cover, really, an illustrated look, 1920s to present. This book's loaded with every conceivable general aviation or light aircraft one can think of. In fact, there are literally tens, maybe hundreds of aircraft in the book I was completely unfamiliar with. Given the actual number of manufacturers and aircraft, of which there are over 800 in this book, it's the sort of book one can go back to and refer to many times when the need arises. So, how's it structured and compiled? Well, it's an A to Z of the manufacturers, and then various aircraft types explained by the author from each of these aviation stables. Truth is, I don't know how Ron Smith chose a particular aircraft to write about, but it's quite a nice summary of each, to be honest. The thing I do like, though, is that where the data exists, Ron's noted the number of aircraft that exist on a particular register, maybe the US, the UK, Australia, Canada, a combination of these. And what this does is it allows the reader to make a real judgment on the operational current status of that particular aircraft type. In addition, the text helps one establish the real capabilities of that aircraft. So, for example, I never knew Aleutian built light aircraft, and the author in the summary for the IL-103 mentions its use mainly for military training in countries like Laos, South Korea and Peru, and that 66 have been built to date. By the way, it's actually quite a nice looking aircraft. As expected, they're the big players in there, the Cessnas, the Beechcrafts, the Jodels, and of course I could go on. But what I like about these sections is that these summaries get as much lineage as the smaller manufacturers. And that's good why, because it means you don't get a book loaded with material that's already well scribed and covered. We get to read about some of the less well-known types, but in the context of the whole sector, so not missing the big players out either. Now, the British Aircraft Manufacturing Company, the Granville Brothers to name but two, I'd never heard of. You see, that's where this is a great book. There's a multitude of new information on less well-known aircraft types. They're supported by one of the best, if not the best, general aviation or classic light photography collections in a book that certainly I've ever seen. Every page has three or four good quality photographs of the aircraft. Over the past few weeks, I've found myself picking the book up, seeing something new every single time. But it's this great visual supporting photography that accompanies the text that really makes this book work. You can pick it up, never look at it for a while, but I'll assure you, if you're in any way interested in light aircraft, this is a real feast of visual and knowledgeable text to build your understanding further. And let's not forget, every fast jet pilot, heavy metal aircraft pilot, airline pilots, and even astronauts probably started their journey on one of these platforms. Now, that's how important this segment of the sector is. Never forget that. When all the flight simming's done, leaving terra firma for most pilots probably starts here. So, what don't I like about this book? I'm struggling, really, to find something that really doesn't work for it. I could be critical and say there's just not enough detail, but with 800 aircraft, how much detail can you go into in the space given? So for me, there's not too much that's wrong with this book. There's also a great index of manufacturers in the back. I will say this, the quality of this book physically is outstanding. The glossy paper, it feels expensive and high grade, and its weight in the hand as you turn each page makes you feel like you've got something in front of you. If you're buying this for someone as a present, you'll really be proud of yourself for finding something this nice to give. There's some questions though that I did need answering, so I went to find the author Ron Smith and ask him myself. Now, the first question I wanted to ask him was, how did he come up with these aircraft types, the 800 he chose, from the thousands and thousands out there? What was his criteria for inclusion?
Well, I've been interested in small aeroplanes for a long time because it's always been my view. There's a lot more variety and interest out there than there is at a typical airport looking at commercial aircraft. So I wanted to capture something of the variety of light aircraft without getting totally out of hand in terms of length. So the main consideration was, are these aircraft really designed for private owners? So it's easier to talk about what's not included. So commercial aircraft, helicopters, agricultural aircraft, gliders, balloons, microlights. There's all sorts of things you could think about, but those are, I've excluded those as not really being private owner in terms of the size of aircraft we're looking at. I've also not put in warbirds like Mustangs and Spitfires and things of that nature, but I have included ex-military trainers like the Harvard and the Mentor and the Percival Provost and so on.
Is that because a lot of them are used in the GA market?
Absolutely. I think that nowadays those aircraft that have come out of the air forces where they're still flying, they tend to be in the hands of private owners rather than being run on as commercial enterprises.
Yeah.
But I've also included... I've also excluded sort of the really unique one-off home builds, and I could give you a list of those. I'm kind of concentrating on what you might see if you turned up and looked at your local airport, particularly if there was a fly-in on where there was going to be a range of aircraft attending.
So how were you able to write so comprehensively about some of these lesser-known models? Where'd you find them?
Well, some of that reflects the length of time that I've been interested in aircraft. And I have to say that myself and my twin brother Jim started taking photographs of aircraft when I was at school. So we are talking more than 50 years ago. And when we started this collection of photographs, we took pictures of things that were old, which made them inherently interesting, and also absolutely everything that we didn't immediately recognise. And a lot of those were light aircraft. And so over time, you start to build up a fairly comprehensive knowledge of what I might call the old and obscure. And over the same period, of course, I built up a library of different reference books. And again, there are some key books out there. There was a series called The Aircraft of the World, produced by McDonald's, which I've got three editions of. There's Jupner's book on US civil aircraft, which was published in no less than 8 volumes. There's A.J. Jackson's British Civil Aircraft in 3 volumes. And so on. And the end result is, with a good library, you will find that a lot of these obscure aircraft are actually findable. In this day and age, there is also the internet. Of course, you've got to know what name to search for.
Yeah.
But also, there's online national aircraft registries. So quite often, you can find out what the aircraft is, and the name may not mean very much to you. Small amount of digging, you can find out a lot more.
So what other research were you doing? Were you using those sorts of archival sources, the internet and that sort of thing? Was there anything else you used?
Well, I started by shortlisting the candidate manufacturers and the types to include. And I then went through my own photo collection to see which of those aircraft I have photographs of what I would say were a publishable quality of.
Yeah.
And where there were gaps. And basically I used my own library for information on lots of types, supplemented by the internet. And I did make a couple of email inquiries for the newer types to some of their manufacturers to find out how many they had actually built so far, because it's quite difficult to tell. You know, somebody might say we've sold 3,000, and what they mean is they've had 3,000 inquiries, which they've sold a certain number of plans. It doesn't mean that any of them are yet flying. So I put some effort into that. And the other thing which I chose to do was, where there are aircraft which lots of people think, oh, they all look the same, like Austers and Jodels and Robans and Warcos and things, I put a little bit of effort into researching the differences and providing enough information there that somebody can be a bit more knowledgeable about, oh, it's an Oster J5G or something, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And really, that was as much as anything else. And I suppose the other thing I did was I looked on the national registers to see how many aircraft were still had live registrations. It doesn't actually mean they're necessarily flying, but perhaps not obvious from when you initially pick up the book, is my intention has been, by and large, to focus on aircraft that are actually still flying. The majority of these photographs are not of aircraft sat in museums. Most of them are still flying today. Some of them, maybe there are a few maybe that have now retired from the scene, but are still well enough known to be worth including. But
And that is one thing that's particularly impressive about the book, and that's the photographs. I did notice some of your aircraft in there, but an amazing collection. Most of them yours, were they?
Well, thank you for saying that. I have to say that 90% of the photographs included. There's 849 photographs, I think.
Yeah.
And 90% of those are my own. And
it's quite an amazing collection, Ron.
Well, I have been taking aircraft photographs since 1963.
Yeah.
And the oldest photograph that I can definitively date that's in my current collection was taken in 1964. And the oldest photograph in this book was actually taken in either 1968 or 1969.
Right.
So to some extent, I have got a very large collection. It is very diverse. And you know, this book to a degree is a showcase for the collection that I've got.
And I think that's a nice word and a nice descriptor for the book. It is a lovely showcase. I think of those 850 odd photos, I can't remember too many black and white ones. They're all colour. They're very sharp. They're not taken on DSLRs, but they're nice quality, nice colour. That's a lot of work. How long did this book take you to put together?
Well, there are a few digital photos, but the thoughts about putting this together as a piece of work really started at the beginning of 2013. And I started actively working. First thing to do was to accumulate the photographs, identify the ones that I wanted to use, and scan those that weren't available digitally. And that's quite a bit of work. And I wrote each chapter as I'd got the set of photographs I needed for that chapter. And so the book itself was written from mid-2013 to mid-2014. So it took about a year all round, which is perhaps less than you might think. But to some extent, because there are so many photographs and there are so many aircraft to cover, there's perhaps fewer words than you might have had. If I'd chosen to write everything I knew or could find about each type, the book would have been too big.
Yeah.
It would have been, oh, I've done this in eight volumes, and you think, well, who's going to buy eight volumes of that?
Yeah, and I love the book because of that. It makes it digestible, I suppose. And a picture says 1,000 words, you know, you can really see. Because they're quite large pictures as well. And as I say, nice and colourful. Anyone else contribute to the makeup of the book?
Well, in terms of the content itself, the main external contributors were in gap filling on the photograph side, of whom my twin brother's collection, and he has travelled widely, partly because he had a job in the British Embassy in Washington, and he's currently resident in Australia. So, and like myself, he's been taking aircraft photos for 50 years. So he's the number one contributor in terms of other photographs. There's also Peter Davison, who's a fellow member of the Royal Aeronautical Society Historical Group, Jeff Jacobs from the Cessna 172 Club. And I also contribute to a website called 1000aircraftphotos.com, which is run by a chap called Ron Dupas and a Dutch guy whose name I will no doubt ruin, Johan Visjedijk. And they were very helpful in putting me in contact with other contributors on the site where I needed, I could identify from their collection a really nice photograph and say, it would be really good to get a copy of that. And so they could say, here's the guy's email address, ask him nicely, he'll almost certainly say yes. And of course, they almost certainly do say yes. So I have benefited from that. But we are talking about, say, 80 photographs out of the 850. And I would also mention Rod Simpson, who is the chairman of Air Britain. He was helpful in terms of both encouraging me to complete the work. He also provided three of the images, and I'm very grateful for that. He's written extensively in this area, and two of the references that I have used are his book, Air Life's General Aviation, and another book, which I think is called Air Life's World Aviation. And that's, you know, in terms of your referencing, where can I find out information on these obscure types? Well, yeah, that's one of the places you could look.
Okay. Well, we've been asked quite a few times to feature general aviation on the show. I think this is a fantastic starting point for anyone who wants to learn a bit more about what's in the sector. But I know you've already completed quite a few books. This one is quite a tome. It's big, it's heavy, it's comfortable. But is there any more in the Ron Smith stable to come?
Well, there is one additional manuscript with Schiffer Publishing, which I hope will therefore be produced to the same general standard, that's due out next year, which is a similar book on Cessna's twin engine family of aircraft, so from the Cessna 310 and so on. And I had the benefit there of being able to use some photographs from the Cessna Aircraft Company as well as my own photos.
Right.
And several other people also being helpful with contributing images for me. So that one is due out next year. I don't really have any other active projects, although I would probably be interested in a book that provided the same opportunity as this one to showcase some other aspects of my photo collection. And there's also, of course, scope to update this book should it sell well enough that Schiffer are interested in doing a second edition.
Ron, I mentioned earlier that I'd seen one or two of your aircraft in the book. How many are there in the book, and what association have you got with some of these aircraft?
Well, I've owned five different aircraft, which are two Jodels, two Luscombs, and a Tipsy B, 1938 Tipsy B.
Yep, saw that one.
And of the aircraft types illustrated, I think I've flown or flown in at least 50 of the types that are in the book.
Wow.
Now, I wouldn't say, you know, I don't want to give the impression I've flown all these, but I have. You know, if you think about the turbulent, the Luton Minor, through to and I've taken off and landed the RLU Breezy, Beach Bonanza. Anyway, there's about 50 types in there. Some of them I have just flown in as a passenger.
Yeah.
But there's a fair number of those that yes, I have actually flown solo or taken off and landed.
And let's not forget, you were a qualified pilot during this period. So when you say flown in, you do actually mean flown quite a few of these. Your local airfield's Hendridge?
Yes, it's just 5 minutes drive away. It's about a mile and a half or something like that. Yeah. So some might say that might have something to do with where the house is.
Well, if anyone's interested in learning a bit more about GA and some of the variety out there, this is a fantastic place to start. Ron, thank you very much for joining us. We'll put some links in the show notes to your Twitter feed, because I know you do put some of these photos out there on that as well. Thanks very much for joining us.
That's fine. I'm happy to talk to you and that you're interested in the work.
Okay, Ron there talked about his choice of aircraft that went into the book. As I said, great visual feast of photographs, and I struggled to understand his criteria for choosing them. But what he said to me is, it's great going down to the local airfield because you get a much greater variety of aircraft than you do at any airport these days. And I suppose my question to you two guys is that true? You know, is an A320, is a 737, is a 777, is an A330? Do they all look the same these days?
Yeah.
How to diplomatically answer that? Yeah, well, yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I think, yeah, you
I don't want to do old man Johnson, but when I was a kid, you know, you had you had Tridents, you had 727s, you had, you know, you had turboprops, you had jumbo jets. There was every sort of shape and size and configuration, and nowadays there's pretty much two engines on the wings of each airliner, and that's it.
I suppose the thing is with you know, going to a big airport is you know, there's people obviously who are that ilk, you know, people are kind of looking for, you know, the registry or perhaps even like, you know, special schemes. But you know, you've got the scheduled flights there, you know exactly what's coming in, you know that it's going to be, you know, you know, Qatar Airways A380 in landing at whatever time. Whereas I suppose you go to a small airfield, you've no idea what's going to be there from one day to the next. You know, you've got, you know, got a certain number of kind of home aircraft base there, and then all of a sudden something else, you know, well, look, a Mustang has just flown in, what the heck, you know. You know, you're more likely to get some kind of sort of special treat that kind of flies in on occasion and just, you know, about it. I think that's the other thing, maybe is just,
yeah,
just,
that's,
you,
true.
You know, that's a sort of,
it's
a personal,
much more
special
intimate thing, isn't it,
special treat that you would just know about it. Whereas, you know, if there's a special flight on to Heathrow or Manchester, wherever, everybody, you know, social media gets the word around, everyone knows about it.
Yeah.
The world and his dog turn up with cameras and you know, you kind of...
And it's on Twitter 30 seconds later. I think the great thing about what Ron's done, though, is he's brought some unique aircraft into the picture as well. And I learned a lot about some aircraft I never even knew existed. It's a great read. It's a great book. I'm really, really pleased I got a copy of it to put on my shelf. So do go out and have a look at that if you're interested in general aviation.
This is Max Flight. I love aviation podcasts. That's why I do Airplane Geeks, the UAV Digest, and the PaxX podcast. But when I need a break from creating my own shows, I turn to Extended. Peter, Tim, and Gareth do a stellar job and bring us all interesting and informative episodes. Extended, a great aerospace program.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the Get Involved and Feedback section of the show, our friends at Slipstream Research sent us a message to say we're very proud to announce that the design work for their first aircraft, the Slipstream Model 313, has been completed. So congratulations to everybody there, and hopefully we'll get that team back on the show again to find out a bit more about how they're doing. Also, it's nice to know what he's flying these days, as we talked to him about flying the Osprey last time. Good friend of the show, Mehdi Azaray, sent us a tweet which was a link to The Aviationist, and it was some video of an Iranian F-14 escorting Russian Tu-95s over Iran en route to striking in Syria. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes, anyone who missed that. We shared a story on social media, the tale of a marine mechanic who stole an A4 Skyhawk. It drummed up some interest, and another story that came out about a C-130 out of Mildenhall in 1969 that went through a similar process and was, I believe it was shot down over the channel as well. Did anyone heard that story?
I have never heard that story, I have to confess.
Right, okay.
I've heard vaguely about that, yeah, about someone taking it. I'm not sure whether it was a mechanic as well.
Yeah, that's
or
right,
someone
it was.
Taking it.
Yeah,
I think there's some sort of debate or controversy about whether the person actually kind of ran out of fuel and then just sort of, you know, stole it and then ran out of fuel and crashed in the sea, or whether an aircraft was sort of scrambled and shot it down. So,
interesting. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for anyone who missed out on that. But thanks very much, Kangaroo Opal, Zach Yates, and Errol as well for their input on that. Also, one interesting piece of information we also stumbled across was the Lockheed 1011. Didn't know it had a built-in staircase before the days of jetways. We posted a picture on Facebook, which got some interesting feedback as well. Ben from Down Under said, actually, many of the early Virgin Blue 737 NG deliveries had stairs optioned on them. So thanks very much for that. And finally, Dr. Stuart Gray, another previous guest on the show, shared some graphics with us on space debris, which are pretty impressive. Pretty frightening, but pretty impressive. So we'll put some links to that in the show notes as well. And we're hoping to get Dr. Stuart Gray back on the show in the new year. Okay, promoting aerospace, shout outs for those good causes. First is Dave Gledhill, of course, a guest on the show, probably one of our most popular shows ever, a few months ago, talking about the Phantom, of course. He's offering signed copies of his books, so you can get over to his website and order a copy. After he was on the show, I got his book, Phantom in Focus, and I will say, excellent, excellent read. I know you're a great supporter of his work, Gareth.
Yeah, he's brilliant. And I puts you right in the cockpit, which is a horrendous cliche, but it's so true.
And also one more shout out from me. Exactly two years ago, we featured the book Jim the Jet Provost with author Amanda Cundall. And we're absolutely delighted to say the book was published last month. So if you still need a present for a youngster, we recommend Jim the Jet Provost. The artwork is by Spencer Trickett, and I believe they're going to be offering some signed copies as prizes on their website early in the new year. So do look them up. We'll put links in the show notes to that. Tim, anything from you?
Prone in aerospace. Well, let's see. I suppose a couple of quick ones is, first off, we're recording this on the 7th of December, 43 years ago. That was Apollo 17, the last mission to the moon. Great website I discovered over the weekend and in the middle of deadlines was apollo17.org. Fantastic NASA, NASA resource. It's a collection of mission audio, YouTube, film, and still pictures, all to put together an interactive timeline. It is a must browse if you have got even the vaguest interest in space, and done by a sort of years of work by a volunteer. It's not a NASA, an official NASA website.
Wow.
So that's one quick thing. And obviously the other thing I'd say is, you know, we've mentioned Tim Peake. Keep up to date with Tim Peake's mission. There's a whole lot of stuff going on the launch on the 15th, but there's also sort of a STEM outreach, coding challenges, train like an astronaut. If you've got kind of young kids, if you're in the UK, even if you're not in the UK, if you've got kids and they're a little bit interested in engineering, this is the time to get them in. Tim is going to be a big social media space superstar by in 6 months' time when he comes back from the space station. Keep following him, give him all the support, get involved.
And one other thing, Tim, I was talking to Brian Riddle, who is, of course, the chief librarian for the National Aerospace Library down in Farnborough. He mentioned to me that there is going to be another book sale to be held, and it's going to be held this time at the library in Farnborough. I believe it's in mid-January. So I know at the moment there is a very, very large amount of interest from some of our listeners for aviation books. If you're really interested in getting to Farnborough, we'll put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
The Voices in Your Head.com.
Let's take a little bit of time out then just to have a look back at 2015 and also a little look ahead to 2016 just before we wrap up then. Let's talk about the year that's slowly finishing on us now. It's been a year of ups and downs. Sadly, some crashes. We saw, of course, the loss of the A400 German wings. We saw that terrible TransAsia ATR-72 coming down. And more recently, of course, the military action in Syria, where we've lost some aircraft. But it hasn't all been bad news for the industry. There's been some great stuff too. We've seen the C series come bouncing back. Well, I'm not quite sure if bouncing is the right term. We see Mitsubishi, of course, as well, roll out their aircraft. We've had Solar Impulse too. There's been some good stuff as well, hasn't there?
Like I say, some sort of pretty tragic events. German Wings suicide. The pilot suicide there, I think, kind of really shocked everybody.
Yeah, it's very sobering, wasn't it?
And then only recently we've had the Russian charter A320 blown up. When was the last time somebody actually got a bomb on an aircraft? Horrendous stuff again, like you said, in the A400, but also the AW609. Crashes there in the very small, very, very tightly knit European flight test community.
We saw that aircraft at Yeovilton, didn't we, Gareth? It was airframe. We did. Sadly.
But there's been been some good stuff as well. I mean, like you say, series that came and made a splash at Paris. People were impressed with it. They're still trying to pull it back and trying to sort of save it. I think maybe one of the big highlights is a space pilot highlight, Pluto.
Yes.
Pluto flyby.
Yes, of course.
Amazing pictures still coming in. Just incredible. We've also got earlier this year, it was announced that Heathrow was the preferred choice for Davis Commission. Now, whether that actually is going to be, whether actually decision to actually do anything is going to go on and be a put back another sort of 6 months, who knows?
Yeah.
But at least that commission has now reported. So that's progress of a sort. We've had Airbus in Alabama. That's Airbus opening their first US factory on Boeing's turf and going great guns there. The Boeing, Airbus, they are, they may not have had many sales at the recent Dubai Air Show. That was a bit of a damp squib as far as air shows go. But, they're both into, production mode and churning stuff out. I mean, at the end of this year, in fact, there's going to be the first delivery of the A320neo to Qatar Airways. Yeah. This is just being imminent next couple of weeks, maybe next 3 weeks before the end of the year. And the A320 is Airbus's bread and butter airplane. So again, that's sort of a significant milestone.
What would, before I come to you, Gareth, Tim, what would you say you've really enjoyed, or something special you've taken from this year, or something that's really taken to your heart?
Okay, well, I mean, obviously there's also last season of Vulcan. Can't really forget that. But for me, it was Duxford in September, and it was a sight of 20 plus Spitfires all revving up their engines for the 75th Battle of Britain Air Show. How many Spitfires you could see in one place? I'll probably never ever see that again. So yeah, and then them all taking off and doing the traditional Duxford tail chase, and just the sky being filled with the sound of millions. That was just incredible.
Yeah, quite something. How about you, Gareth?
I think, sadly for me, the year will be forever tainted by the memory of what happened at Shoreham and the impact, not just obviously on the tragedy of the day and the people who lost their lives and the result of that, which obviously will be a lasting effect for those people. But the spin-off, some of the spin-off from the media was absolutely horrendous and left a pretty vile taste in the mouth, with the industry being dissected very, very unfairly. I hope that the air show industry can bounce back from that, because we've already got some shows falling by the wayside. There's no Manchester air show next year. That's just been announced. There's no Dawlish air show next year. The Mid-Air Squadron with its Canberra and Hunter has gone into receivership. They're classic jets. We're talking about classic jets. So, there's going to be, we've still got an investigation and reports to come out as well. I'm a huge, huge believer in the world of air shows, not just from an entertainment perspective, but from an education perspective, and the work that air shows do to promote aviation and flying to people of all backgrounds and all ages. But you have to say mainly the younger generations, the pilots, designers, air traffic controllers of the future, whatever it might be, the Tim Robinsons of the future, the Peter Johnsons, the Gareth Stringers. We all went to air shows when we were kids, and we're sat here, a few years later, still talking about aviation. It's very, very important that we've got people to do that. So Shoreham will, for me, sadly, will forever cast a big shadow over this year. But on a more uplifting note, I agree completely with Tim. Battle of Britain 75th was superb. Could not have been marked in any better fashion, I don't think. And everybody that was involved, from the Battle of Britain Memorial flight to all those private Spitfire owners, I doff my cap to you, because this was probably the last time that any reasonable number of Battle of Britain veterans, sadly, were going to be around to help us remember that those events of 1940. So that was brilliant. And Vulcan, sad to see it go, but so pleased that she got such a great send off. And probably just worth mentioning at this point, if anybody missed the Guy Martin documentary on Channel 4 with the Vulcan, I believe it's coming out on DVD. Just watch it; it's absolutely brilliant. So I guess they're my overriding memories, if you like, of this year.
Okay, well, let's look forward then to 2016. Of course, it's a Farnborough year, which always brings something special to these shores. Dare we say it, we might see an F-35 this side of the pond. Fingers crossed.
Apparently it's been I think it's the Dutch have said once someone's going to attend a Dutch air show, or I saw some kind of rumor there on Twitter in the past week about going to a Dutch air show. So if one's coming across the that far to Holland, then I don't see why I can't stop off. But maybe set expectations low this time and work upwards.
Given events in Syria, Tim, do you think that we'll see anything nice from the Russians at any of our shows this year? I mean, they're pretty occupied in that part of the world, aren't they, and they've been keeping us busy. I mean, that is one thing that's happened in a lot in 2015. A lot more intercepts across the North Sea, haven't there?
You mean, are the Russians going to come to Farnborough and the military?
Yeah.
Well, and if they get lost again, I think it would be unlikely that the moment with the relations between sort of the West and Russia, unless you got some kind of open skies aircraft, I think you know it'd yeah. be. I don't think you're going to see a pack F-18 up. Put it this way,
right? Okay. Do you think we'll get the C series over to this year?
I mean, I think that'll be if they can get a bailout from their kind of government.
Yeah.
That'll be something else to watch. We'll also have maybe the A400M doing a proper display, for proper sort of RAF display, flying yeah. display this time.
Yeah,
that'll be something to look for. F-35, as we say, hopefully, fingers crossed. I would imagine we'll be there. I would think they'll be wanting to make it there, but hey, let's not jinx it. And also Boeing at 100, so
ooh,
we
yes.
might see a whole load of Boeing current aircraft and also Boeing heritage aircraft that might be kind of booked by the organizer or was induced or persuaded to come along. So wouldn't it be great to see Sally B at Farnborough? I'm just putting it out there. I have no special insight, but and obviously it's up for the Farnborough organizers to work these things into kind of how the usual display, but it'd be nice to sort of if that could be done to get some sort of heritage type stuff from Boeing for Farnborough.
How about you, Gareth? What are you looking forward to?
Yeah, I agree with all of that, and I don't want to just sound like I'm being sort of miserable old git, but a far less negative incidents next year, everybody, would be lovely. Thank you very much. And Farnborough, I think, is going to be fascinating. It's funny, just sitting here, just as you guys were talking just then, the whole thing with Russia, I can't really get my head around it. They've spent the whole year sort of probing the defences and all over, and now we're kind of all flying over the same pieces of sky in combat operations. I mean, it's the whole thing's messed up. It's like some sort of James Bond movie or something, isn't it? It's almost like nobody knows who's on whose side anymore. It's
first chapter of the of that Tom Clancy novel that never got written.
Exactly.
There's a couple more things actually I could put in there, Peter. Is
yep.
Firstly, well, Airlander, HAV's Airlander,
all right,
airship,
yes.
should be flying. So
yeah, that'll
we
be
could
interesting
see a
to
next
see. Yeah.
generation airship in the skies in 2016. Imagine yep. if that came to Farnborough. That'd be pretty cool, wouldn't it?
That would be.
And that if that goes on a demo tour, does flight tests, that could potentially, a bit of UK technology, aviation, aerospace technology that could, start off a whole new niche market. We've also got maybe a decision as well about UK spaceport.
Oh, yes. Forgot about that.
So, again, that could be a selection there of where we're going to have the space. So, no spaceport. There's still obviously big kind of questions over there, like who will be there from there in the first place, where, but, the whole Tim Peake effect of, all of a sudden Whitehall is kind of backing a UK spaceport, even 5 years ago. Would you imagine that?
No.
I've
got to say, I'm still struggling with it a little bit. But seeing some of the things in the Strategic Defence Review, we've seen some of the air bases come under threat, of course. I wonder if there's a backhanded deal in terms of looking at some of those potentially as those spaceport locations.
There's Zephyr, the Zephyr UAV, which we talked about. That's
yep.
set to fly and to stay airborne for 3 months. 3 months. That is going to smash the endurance record of 2 weeks. And that's world-beating technology. And finally, obviously, finally, leave the best to last. It's the 150th anniversary of the Royal Aeronautical Society, formed in January 1866. So there's going to be a whole lot of things going on throughout the year.
Does that mean you bring cake to the next episode?
Probably, yeah, you've got me there.
And every episode during the year.
So, if there's a branch near you, good time to find out what they're doing, go around, get involved, and keep an eye out for all our 150th sort of anniversary events and content and articles and blogs and what have you.
Well, that's probably just about it. We will be at Farnborough in 2016 in some shape or other. I know some of our sister programs are also planning to attend the public weekend. So if you're planning to be there on one of the public days, you need to look up the Airplane Geeks and the Airline Pilot Guy team, because they're looking to meet up. Okay, before we leave you, we've got some great content coming to you over the Christmas break, featuring the museums of all the three UK military services. So we hope you all both enjoy the episode we bring you, and hopefully you'll be able to get down to one of the museums itself. So look out for that in your feeds. We'd also like to say a very big thank you to Event Fire Solutions, to Tony and the team there, for all the support they've given us in the last 6 months. It's made a big difference to us, some of the things that they've been able to do to help us. So thank you very much. If you're interested in supporting the show, do get in contact. You've heard the exposure that EFS have at the beginning of our program. So if you'd like to be in that spot, do get in touch. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon this year as well for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, the Pod Directory, and of course, iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, the Aeronautical Society website is www.aerosociety.com, and I'm tweeting at RESTimR.
And if you're not following Tim, you really, really should. Gareth, where can we find you?
Global Aviation. resource.com for all of that, and you should also be following me if you're not already, and it's Gareth _Stringer on Twitter.
Always brings a smile to my face, Gareth, to see you on social media. So do get over and follow Gareth as well. You'll find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at XTP Media, of course. So with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
It's goodbye from me, yep. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
50 knot out. Thanks for listening.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned into this frequency. Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio station. Oh, and wherever you are in the world, Tim, Gareth and I wish you a peaceful and happy holiday break.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.